You and happiness. Today, on the last of this week's series of informal conversations, Dwight Cook has as his guest Dr. Robert K. Merton, author of the book Mass Persuasion and professor of sociology at Columbia University. Here now is Dwight Cook.
Well, Dr. Merton, all week, my guest and I have been talking about men and women and their happiness, but purely as individuals, I might almost say, in terms of their inner life. But it's obvious enough that almost the central new fact which has been added to the 20th century in men and women is this whole set of things that swings around mass production and the machine. And therefore, today, I think if you would be willing, we might focus more on the connection between men and machines and men, women, and machines.
I don't see how you can avoid it. You can't talk about happiness, seems to me, with regard to the way we experience it, unless you realize we live in a mass society and an industrial society dominated in part by the machine.
Well, now, before you talk about the machine, let me get you talking a second more about happiness. Is it fair to ask you what it means to you? I don't care about a definition, but where do you focus on the problem of happiness?
Well, I don't like definitions. If you ask me what I have in mind when I hear the word happiness, I can tell you.
Good.
I think happiness is an experience one has when he satisfies purposes which are shared by other people.
An experience when you pursue purposes shared by other people.
And the last part of that is the all-important part from my point of view.
Don't you think most people tend to think more of happiness as enjoying life without worry and having fun?
Well, since you've asked for my opinion, I'd call that pseudo-happiness. Because in the search for the casual interests, the casual desires, the casual concerns that you have, you end up in a state of mind which is anything but happy. The reason for that, I think, is pretty plain. If you search for what you want, you have no way of knowing what more you will want in the next instance. You don't share those interests with other people. There's no control over them.
Anything?
So it's a kind of an endless search for the infinite, an endless search for the unsatisfiable. And that's what I mean by saying it ends up not in happiness, but in its converse.
For a no-definition of happiness, you're doing pretty well, Dr. Burton.
Well, that's only because you want me to explain what I mean. I surely don't intend that as a definition.
All right, then you have established a very sound foundation of what you mean by happiness here. Now it gets more difficult when you bring the machine in. Is it fair to say that in the old days, well, let's take a cobbler, for instance. In the old days, the cobbler made the shoe. He shaped suit himself. If he wanted to put more heart into it and make it more beautiful or more sturdy, he could do it. When he got through, it was his shoe, and he had created something.
Well, I think that's important. We'd like to talk about that as pride and work, but I don't think we ought to get nostalgic about it. As the one thing I wouldn't be prepared to say about us today in comparison with the people of yesterday is that we are or are not happier than they were. Many of us think of the good old days, and we only mean our youth. Now, I don't know of any way of deciding whether, by and large, people 50 or 100 years ago were happier or unhappier as compared with ourselves.
And yet, as a psychological truth, creating things, sharing in making things is a very important thing for men or women. The man today who's the equivalent of that old-time cobbler stands at a machine and probably feeds a piece of leather into it, which stamps one single thing on the piece of leather. He throws it into the box and reaches for a new one. Wouldn't you say that his satisfaction level was rather smaller?
I would, and it's important, but it's not the whole story. That's to say, the old yarn about men being chained to the machine, of being bored by the monotony of the machine, of being fatigued by overwork, is one of these partial truths. It's true in part, and we consequently tend to believe it's the whole story. But if that man felt that he had a purpose in producing, if that man saw that what happened as a result of his production was in accord with the interests he shared with other people, then even the most monotonous tasks take on their own intrinsic interest.
But until these other things happen, the tasks are monotonous, and man is less happy because he is working at this type of machine.
I think that's a fairly sound statement. One of the problems we face is the fact that so much of our industry is becoming so tremendously specialized. That means not only that a man's doing the same work all of the time, but it means that his friends and associates don't know the kind of work he's really doing. Do you know, for example, what a fin sticker is as compared with other radiator core assemblers?
No, for a minute I thought you were describing something to do with having fun in Florida, but...
No, and there are all sorts of specialties that may never have attracted your notice. Have you ever been interested, for example, in a jelly pumper in a donut factory?
It sounds like a gag rather than...
Well, it's a fact, and he's a very different specialist than a donut sugarer. The point I'm trying to make is that here you have these specialties, the outsider knows nothing about them, and obviously the worker can't feel any pride in his work. That's a major and important difference.
When you talk about men and machines, you aren't using men as contrasted with women, because the stenographer, the secretary, the woman in any kind of a job is trapped in exactly the same kind of a limited...
The white-collar worker is becoming increasingly caught up in the very same routines that the factory worker is, and in both you have your men and your women. We don't really know, I don't, for one, whether it's a distinctively different problem for the women in the case as compared with the men or not.
Well, even if they don't have the problem of women as women, they have the problem that comes right back around the circle to them as wives of men.
And they sure do. The lack of stability, the lack of satisfaction of the men in the plant would be reflected in their home life.
Well, then there's one other negative factor that I should think we could add here, Dr. Merton, and that is not only this lack of satisfaction in working with a modern machine, but also the lack of the Horatio Alger possibility, which is one of the things American happiness seems to have been built on. The ordinary worker in front of the ordinary machine or the ordinary clerk or the ordinary radio man or the ordinary anything else today is fairly certain he is not going to land up a Vanderbilt.
Nonetheless, he lives in a world where he's expected to. And since he's expected to, he can't feel too much self-respect when he gathers that he's failed. The tremendous emphasis here in America on money and success with getting on in the world has had its costs for the unhappiness of those who don't get on. You take the old American phrase, how much does Jonesy make a year? Now, when that phrase is used, it's not intended to refer to how much he's produced a year, but to the size of his income. Our language has caught up in the very same problem. It's no wonder, then, that men at work in production have little self-respect with regard to their job. As a matter of fact, you might be interested in one bit of sociological material. I've tried to keep that off the air. But a recent study of a cross-section of Americans showed that factory jobs and mechanical jobs were generally rated as having the lowest social standing. Now, the important thing is that this was true even in the eyes of workers themselves. They were the ones, just as well as the white-collar people, who were saying that it did not amount to a row of beans if you were simply a machinist or a mechanic.
Well, now, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, that leads to the inevitable problem, then, of men at work and having no respect for what they're doing. That's scarcely a source of happiness.
And at this point, we have wound quite a bit of black crepe around the arm of our civilization, because you certainly are not going to be able to eliminate the machine. The machine is here to stay.
It's here to stay, and I would have no truck with those who long for the days where there were no machines. The problem is not the machine, but what men do with the machine and what the machine does to men.
Well, of course, men have got to continue doing approximately the same monotonous type of work with the machine they are now doing, so obviously you don't mean that by the problem of what men do with the machine.
What they do with it in terms of their own views of how a machine needs to be organized, what they do with it in terms of who controls the production that flows from the machine, the question of who controls the decisions as to when machines are introduced and changed, because this makes all the difference in the world as to whether they have some sense of security in being able to foresee the immediate future or none.
Well, now you've brought in an immensely larger topic even than men and machines here, because you're talking about man's power to control his own destiny or ability to enter into his destiny here. It applies equally well to the hydrogen bomb, doesn't it?
It does indeed. It's the same sort of problem to which I've referred before. But in the context of a mechanical civilization, the essential problem is who makes the big decisions on the use of that machinery, on the use of that technology. A good many workers are not at all sure that new invention is a good thing under present arrangements, because they so often feel if they pay the penalty for new inventions, that their skills are made obsolete, that they are the ones who are displaced by the new machine. I don't think that's inherent in the situation.
Your point is, then, that a man is no longer chained to a machine when he has decided what he and the machine are going to do.
Precisely.
But But that involves the whole problem of who runs the factories and who owns the machines.
Well,
that's a big problem.
It's a big problem, and one that I think we're, some of us, thinking about tackling. It's not a new problem. Those workers who now believe that the essential problem is that of control rather than that of being tied to a machine are the ones who want to have that control for themselves. They consider they have at least as big a stake in the factory as the men and women who own the factory. And when you come to think of it, there's a good case to be made for it.
Well, in a very quiet and modest way here, Dr. Merton, it sounds as if you were proposing fairly, I won't use the word radical here because that has a left-right connotation, but fairly extensive changes in the social system. And it seems to me you're also saying in a very quiet and scientific way that we have got to make these changes or else.
All right. Really intended to say just that, quietly or otherwise.
You did.
That is, there are a good many people who suppose that conflict in our society, conflict of any sort, for any purpose, must be condemned. I don't.
So you mean when the workers and the managers have a conflict over who controls how much of the destiny of the factory, that isn't necessarily a bad thing or a sign of civilization is falling apart?
Quite the contrary. Conflict is a normal part of any kind of change. We had conflict over slavery. We had conflict over child labor legislation. We had conflict over the woman's vote.
Yes, but conflict is no good of and in itself, is it, Dr. Merton? And until the worker, under your description here, until the worker feels that he is controlling the machine in the factory, he is not going to be happy working at the machine.
And that is the place in which conflict comes in. Only through struggling to the point of having an effective hand in making those decisions, only through that kind of conflict can he overcome the difficulties which we've been talking about.
What happens to the owners of the factories? What happens to the people who own the bonds and the stocks?
Well, precisely what's starting to happen to them in Britain today. That is to say, their place in society changes just as the place of the worker in society changes. The notion that there can be a harmony of interest between all people all the time is a very happy one, perhaps, but it's not always true.
But now, unless more people share in the fundamental responsibilities and shaping of policies in this industrial democracy of ours, you think we're going to run into very serious trouble.
I adopt the same view here as I do in the sphere of politics. In our democracy, it's assumed that those who govern and control are responsible to those whom they govern and control. I see no difference between democracy there and democracy in our industrial setting.
And you don't feel that this prescription of yours for releasing man from the thraldom of the machine is a prescription that only a trained sociologist or a good philosopher can follow?
I should think that perhaps both the sociologist and the philosopher are about the worst individuals to call in at this stage of the game.
Are you then saying, in effect, it's up to us to vote ourselves a new kind of a purpose in here?
Only if we get this kind of collective purpose, which has some sort of objective basis, do I think we can curb these tendencies to unhappiness which you and I have been talking about.
But Dr. Merton, thank you for talking so clearly with me about these problems and pointing out what, in your judgment, is the only solution we can have to the problems of the machine age, which in turn are a good many of the problems concerned in our happiness today and tomorrow.
You have been listening to You and Happiness, Columbia's subject of the week in its regular series devoted to topics of popular interest. Joining Dwight Cook today was Dr. Robert K. Merton, professor of sociology at Columbia University. Listen in again next week over many of these same stations when the subject of conversation will be You and Books. CBS announces a new show on Friday nights. It's called Up for Parole, and it brings you reenactments of real stories of men who have been convicted of crime, who have served part of their sentences, and who now are up for parole. You, the radio audience, hear the whole story reviewed. You reach your own decision, and then you hear what the parole boards decided. Up for Parole is heard on most of these same CBS stations. Hear it every Friday night. This is CBS, where you meet Lucille Ball and My Favorite Husband every Sunday night, the Columbia Broadcasting System.